Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's been more than 7 months since Russia's war in Ukraine, and developments are continuing to unfold rapidly. This week, Russia claims more than 200,000 people have been drafted into their army, but the conscription also has sparked an exodus of hundreds of thousands of Russians from their homeland, as well as protests. Many have escaped to neighboring countries. But we're also learning that some are also seeking asylum here in Northern California. Alex Tavarian is an immigration attorney who is active in the Russian, Ukrainian, and broader Slavic community in California. He's joined us on Insight a few times since the onset of the war to share the experiences of Ukrainians fleeing conflict. Alex, welcome back to Insight. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
The last time you joined us, you were heading to Mexico to help Ukrainian refugees connect with their families here in California. Do you have an update on how those Ukrainians are doing, the ones that you helped, and how they're doing today?
Well, I mean, the wave of people who are coming from Ukraine is still in place. There's a program, and I'm sure you guys heard of it, it's called U4U, which has been implemented quite a while ago, and Ukrainian families continue using that program and coming over to the United States. And the only thing that sort of becomes something to think about is when they arrive here, then they have to figure out what they need to do further, because this status is a temporary status, and so that's basically the most major concern for them.
Hmm. How has the flow of refugees from Ukraine to California changed or evolved over the last several months?
I would say that nothing changed in terms of the number. I think it's pretty much exactly the same amount of people keep coming back. It's just when this whole thing unfortunately began, it was for me easier to see, because I was in Tijuana and actually just saw physically people who were getting off the plane and getting in into CBP offices. But right now, obviously we don't see them because there's a U4U program, so everything is done from there. Most of them are in Poland or other countries, and they apply for a program, and thank God that immigration services in the United States are very quick, and they respond and they process the paperwork. So to answer your question, it's still very tragic what's happening there. Russia is invading, and so people are unfortunately have to leave.
Yeah, still very much, unfortunately, in the thick of it, and your work continues. Given that Vladimir Putin, Russia's president, called for a partial mobilization of Russian troops for the war in Ukraine, how has your work here in California been impacted by that development?
Very tremendously, because today most of my clientele is people from Russia who either actually participate in different protests, basically just going on the streets with those placards, you know, say no to war, et cetera, et cetera. And these people, some of these people were detained, some of these people were beaten, but other people might not participate in anything like this. But as soon as this mobilization was announced, I know for a fact that I recently read that only to the country of Kazakhstan, ever since the mobilization was announced, I think it's 98,000 Russian men left Russia, because they don't want to be part of it.
Right, and we've seen those images of Russians fleeing their country, and just really a backlog of vehicles going to neighboring countries.
Yeah.
When, according to one estimate, I believe it was in Bloomberg, the number of Russians who have fled the country is more than the number who've enlisted in the military since this announcement. I mean, what can you tell us about, you know, the Russians that you're helping, and also what you're hearing about what's happening when it comes to the conditions in their country?
Well, like I said, these people come over here. A lot of them go to Armenia or Georgia or Kazakhstan. But I know for a fact, because my Skype is pretty much 24/7, and I receive calls from people. They, for whatever reason, they don't want to stay there, and they want to seek protection from the U.S. So the question that I need to answer when I receive calls like that is whether these people are eligible to seek asylum in the United States. And there was a nice, very positive note when the press, the White House press secretary recently announced that, you know, that people who refuse to be part of this mobilization, they may seek asylum in the United States. That made a lot of people very happy and enthusiastic about, you know, hope about their eligibility for asylum. But it still remains unclear in terms of the law what's going to happen. Mm. And to answer your question about the when you say the conditions in the country, you mean
in Russia?
A lot of families are broken because a lot of women just remain in Russia with, you know, with their children, and their husbands had to run, and a lot of people thank God were able to leave. And unfortunately, I recently read a couple of articles which were pretty shocking, that people who actually are captured and unfortunately have to become part of this mobilization, they complain that you know, the Russian side does not provide anything to them. As a matter of fact, some of them even wrote that they had to use their own money to purchase uniforms. They don't have anything. The conditions are horrible, and yet Vladimir Putin says that, you know, this is a very, very patriotic war, and we have to be proud that we're doing this. How, you know, ridiculously enough.
Mm. Alex, you've been practicing law here since 2009, but you're from Russia. You received your law degree in Russia. As someone with such deep ties to this country, how are you processing everything that's happening?
Very difficult. Ever since the war started, you cannot not be emotional, because unfortunately, in light of my work, this is what I see every day. These are the people I talk to every day, and it's very difficult. And I'm looking for those mechanisms to be able to sort of have some sort of a shield, not to be very emotionally disturbed, but in reality, it's very difficult.
Do the Russians that are seeking asylum, do they seek any unique challenges apart from Ukrainians, or any specific challenges that they may face afterwards if they are granted asylum here in California?
Well, that's, like I said, that's the thing that the challenge for me and for other immigration lawyers, because most of these people who call us, basically, their story is very short. They say that I am against the war, and please help me. I want to seek asylum in the United States. And there's a caveat in that, and I explained this on several YouTube programs. It's one thing when people actually go on the streets, and then they get punished by the Russian law enforcement. They have eligibility for asylum, whereas where you just run away from mobilization, I guess the question remains is whether they can be eligible for asylum in light of the fact that basically what they did is they just avoided the law. And I mean, this is, I understand that it's a ridiculous law, but it's the law of the country. And the question for me in the future is how immigration judges will look at it, whether they can still provide protection, or they will say, you guys did not prove your eligibility.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point about how this will shape immigration in the future. What conversations are you having with your colleagues, attorneys who are also involved in immigration?
Yes, I mean, we're all looking in the same direction, to be honest with you, because we're all bombarded with people who need our help. And and like I said, I mean, pretty much the facts are the same, very, very, very the same. So, and just for us, we just want to know how these things are going to unfold in the future in terms of decisions by immigration judges, because I know that, you know, for example, Sacramento immigration judges, they're my favorite. It's the best immigration court in the country. I love them, and I know that these judges will, you know, I have faith that we will be able to help someone. Whereas obviously, you know, if we go to some other states, then it might be a much bigger challenge.
Given when you're talking about the U4U program and then the asylum that's offered to refugees, I mean, it is temporary. Have you been talking with Ukrainians who've sought asylum, who are actually already, even though we're still in the midst of war, are thinking about or entertaining the idea of returning home to Ukraine?
As a matter of fact, I did. I spoke with some families who actually just, that's exactly what they told me. They said, Alex, we're here, you know, if you can help us with something, but we're not going to live here. We love our country. We want to go back to Ukraine. And we just, you know, our prayers go out that this war is going to stop soon and we want to return to our country.
Mm. Given that this war is now in its seventh month, it has impacted so many lives, millions globally. Is there anything that gives you hope that this will end at any point relatively soon? Because the way things are developing, I mean, I think it gives a lot of people pause.
Well, unfortunately, Vicky, I personally don't think it's going to end very soon, because statistically, just you guys, I know you guys keep track of all those facts as well. Statistically, the Russian army is losing. Ukrainians are protecting their land, and the reason why it's not going to stop anytime soon, because the Russian side did this unlawful annexation of several territories in Ukraine, and now everybody's fear is that maniac Putin might use atomic bomb or something relatively small, as they say, but they say that if Ukraine will continue fighting for the lands which are now official Russian territories, Putin threatens that he's going to use like chemical weapons, and that's what we are looking into and keeping our fingers crossed that somebody there may interfere, hopefully, and maybe some sort of a coup is going to occur in Russia, because otherwise nobody can stop this person.
Mm. Alex, finally, you know, as we're all continuing to follow developments, I mean, this is still being covered in the media and in publications. When you're reading through or watching developments unfold and how it's being covered in the United States, is there anything missing from the conversation that you think people should better understand?
No, I think the U.S. understands this situation very well. As a matter of fact, we all must remember that President Biden was the only person who was saying to President Zelensky that Russia is going to go inside the country. They're going to start the war. And everybody, including Vladimir Zelensky, basically were saying that, you know, President Biden, you know, please calm down. You know, your intelligence is not right. And look, who was right? President Biden, the U.S. administration was intelligence demonstrated that they were right, because they whatever they predicted, exactly the same thing happened. So I think it's certainly well covered here.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Alex Tavarian is an immigration attorney shedding more light on the Russians and Ukrainians seeking asylum here in Northern California. Up next, it's been called a shadow pandemic, a discussion about the growing need for domestic violence support and resources. The nonprofit Weave, which is the leading provider in Sacramento County, joins us to unpack the biggest changes more than 2 years since the onset of the pandemic. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Since the beginning of the pandemic, there have been serious discussions about the unintended consequences of sheltering at home beyond just COVID-19. The United Nations has called it a shadow pandemic, a rise in domestic violence that is difficult to measure behind closed doors, but one that the UN believes has risen to unprecedented levels globally. The Harvard Gazette reports an increase in the United States at about 8% following 2020 lockdowns, but finding an accurate number is difficult because calls to hotlines dropped at the beginning of the pandemic, but that doesn't mean domestic violence dropped. 2.5 years in, we're starting to get a better picture of the demand of domestic violence resources as well as support and prevention. Weave is a leading provider for domestic violence, sexual assault, and sex trafficking in Sacramento County. Joining us now is CEO Beth Hassett. Nice to see you, Beth.
Nice to be here.
You know, I have interviewed you multiple times. I've never asked you, what does WEAVE stand for?
You know, originally it stood for Women Escaping a Violent Environment, which we stopped using 2 decades ago. And we've reframed it in recent months as When Everyone Acts, Violence Ends, because it's a much more positive statement. And really, it's a call to action to our community versus people escaping things. And we serve more than just women. We serve children, men, non-binary folks.
Yeah. Preliminary numbers nationally show an 8% increase in domestic violence, but your focus is on Sacramento County. Would you say that is accurate or is that a conservative number?
I think that's a conservative number. I mean, we definitely saw, as you noted, a drop off in the number of people calling our support line initially. But once things started opening back up, the floodgates opened, and so many people are continuing to come to us, realizing that what they experienced was domestic violence, and finally feeling like maybe they could seek help.
Mm. When you say realize, I mean, I think that's an important piece in this, is that, you know, I think there's a lot of processing that needs to go on in the aftermath of domestic violence.
People get really fixated on physical violence, and if there's not a physical element, they don't feel like what's happening for them counts. And that's why we encourage people to really understand that there are 6 different types of domestic violence somebody might be experiencing, including financial abuse, sexual abuse, all of these elements that might be in a relationship without that actual physical violence.
Given that you had this influx of calls a couple of years into the pandemic, what did you learn about the sheltering in place and the lockdowns from 2020 and the impact that it had on domestic violence?
You know, it looked a lot like the recession looked to me. People who were trapped in homes with folks that they're in a very dangerous relationship with, or even just an unhealthy relationship, things really escalating, the violence becoming worse, and people feeling very hopeless about where they could go. And with the housing shortage in this region, it's not getting any better. People just aren't in a position to leave, and that keeps them in very dangerous homes.
Yeah, I mean, because this is all interconnected. You know, you're talking about stressors of cost of living and housing affordability, coupled with, you know, 2 years ago, people being at home and sheltering in place, but then you're stuck with an abuser, you know, when you had an outlet to get outside.
You know, it really was the big aha moment during the pandemic was just the intersectionality of all of these things. Lack of access to health care, lack of access to mental health services, poverty, racism, all of those things play into people just feeling like there's no help for them, not seeking help until things have gotten really, really escalated.
Do you have an idea? I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, an exact number of the increase in calls and need that WEAVE has received in the past year.
I can tell you, just looking at our legal line, which is a very specific service, 3 times as many people call our legal line still today. And that's people really looking for, you know, the criminal legal system to help them, whether it's a restraining order or getting a divorce or child custody issues. To me, that's a big, big indicator that things are bad and not getting better.
Mm. Are there other big changes that you're seeing in the work that WEAVE does?
You know, what's been really, really interesting and good that came out of this is I think that our community developed a deep empathy for what it must be like to be a victim, to be isolated, to be trapped and have no options. You know, this whole idea of why doesn't she just leave, I feel like it's fading away because people really get it. And I feel like people are really feeling charged up and wanting to do something to help other people. It's no longer somebody else's problem. It's not Weave's thing to take care of. People are really feeling like they might have a role in helping their neighbor, their friend, the person they go to church with.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about an increase in awareness, an increase in compassion, and even just humility, understanding your own blind spots. Why do you think that larger conversation is taking place and it's happening now?
You know, I think the thing that really triggered it was at the beginning of the year, we had a series of domestic violence homicides. And the first one included three children. And people got very incensed and wanted to do something and really started talking, music to my ears, why aren't we going upstream? Why aren't we preventing this? Why are we waiting for people to die or be in harm's way before we do anything about it? So I think there's this renewed passion around getting in front of this issue and solving the problem now and for future generations and taking a two-generational approach to ending domestic violence.
Yeah, when laws and policy fall short and you can do everything right.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, we've also participated in CAP Radio's After the Assault podcast. That series aired last year, and it's just a powerful series built on years of really building relationships and trust with survivors of sexual assault to really better understand the aftermath of sexual violence during police investigations included, but also how healing can happen when justice does not happen. What response did you receive following this podcast at Weave? You know, because we talk about those aha moments, and I think a lot of people had them after listening to the podcast.
It was very validating for survivors because the average survivor does not see justice. They don't go to trial. Very often, the person isn't arrested. There isn't enough evidence. Unfortunately, our DA's office doesn't charge that many of these crimes. And we've seen disturbing trends in the sexual assault field as well during the pandemic. So many unhoused women being assaulted, and we just have nowhere to take them, nowhere to send them. A lot of people meeting folks on dating apps and being assaulted. So those are the two trends that are really alarming to me. And those are people who probably aren't going to see justice and aren't going to feel like anything was resolved. So I think that talking about what you do afterwards and how you move forward with your life is an important part of the healing and important part of the story.
Yeah, I mean, the number of those experiencing homelessness is skyrocketing. It's increasing because of the pandemic, and we're talking about the intersection of issues. I mean, I think about, you know, if you are by yourself and if you are a woman experiencing homelessness, how do you, I guess, what are the challenges with reaching out to this very vulnerable population who may not feel comfortable, you know, calling 911 or reaching out for support?
You know, that's one of the biggest problems in our entire community is there are whole subsets of the population that do not want to interface with the criminal legal system in general, law enforcement in particular, and making sure that people know that Weave and other supportive services aren't going to make you interface with law enforcement is an important part of our messaging because people are afraid their kids are going to get taken away. They're afraid they're going to end up in jail or that their partner will end up in jail, and they don't have a lot of faith in the systems.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope that or want people to better understand when it comes to the challenges of finding a safe space for individuals who are non-binary, gender non-conforming, or trans?
You know, a lot of the violence perpetrated against people happens to that community in particular. And especially with youth, we see a lot of kids not getting the help they need, having survival sex, even putting themselves in harm's way because it's the safest thing that they can find for themselves. So being open and using your pronouns and welcoming people in and being a safe space, it's a challenge and it takes work. And, you know, we've got a program where we go and train folks in the workplace about why it's important to talk about pronouns and be welcoming and how to be a place where people feel safe working and coming in if you're a business that invites customers in. It's an important part of just the whole community feeling safe for people who don't often feel safe.
You touched upon cost of living, and I just am curious, how big of a role do you think it plays in this problem, a cost of living and housing affordability in terms of trying to get out and find support, and even for your nonprofit and providing that support as well?
You know, it's a huge part of the problem because for instance, with sex trafficking victims, we are trying to help them make money in a different way, live in a different way. And if they can't afford a place to live, if they can't get a job that's going to pay them enough to support themselves and their families, they're not going to leave that life. Same with domestic violence victims. It's just, it's overwhelming to even contemplate leaving. At least I have a roof over my head. You know, it's Maslow. And for them, even if they're living in a dangerous situation, having food on the table and a roof over your head absolutely trumps getting out of a dangerous or unhealthy relationship.
And I would imagine it gets further compounded if you have children.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have a lot of housing that we run. And I can tell you, people stay the full 6 months in our emergency shelter. People stay the full 2 years in our transitional housing. The pipeline that we used to have of moving people out, finding them an affordable place, maybe paying their first and last month's rent for them, there aren't even landlords for us to move people into the homes of. So, you know, that whole pipeline's gotten really clogged during COVID, and it's just not moving.
Mm. What is the greatest need now? How can people help?
You know, we're really challenging people this month to do something, to act to end domestic violence in our community. I feel like people are poised to want to do something, and there's so much we can all do, even if it's just educating yourself about what it looks like, learning what the types of domestic violence are, learning how to support somebody, because that little bit of support might be the thing somebody needs to take that next step. And I think people underestimate how much power there is in just being compassionate and recognizing the signs of domestic violence.
Right, because October is Domestic Violence Action Month. The operative word is action. And WEAVE's goal is 31,000 acts in October. What does that look like? 31,000, that's a good number.
It's 1,000 a day, and we're counting everything. We want people to do the hashtag, if you're on social media, of Acts for WEAVE, or When Everyone Acts, Violence Ends. Giving money is an act, planning a training at your workplace or at your house of worship. All of those things count. Educating yourself. You can go on our website and fill out a form and say, this is what I did. And we're looking for people to do crazy stuff and interesting things and really, really show that they're behind survivors in our community and that they're part of the solution.
Right, because money is important, but action is more. Action doesn't always involve money.
No, and we love money, but we're not going to get there just by people writing a check and then sitting back and feeling like they did all that they could do. We need people really thinking deeply about how can I affect this problem and how can I be part of the change?
Given that you are receiving an influx in need, I mean, do you have enough at WEAVE to shoulder all of this and to help people?
You know, we don't. The things we can control are our waiting list for counseling, and counseling's often the thing that encourages somebody and gives them the strength to make different choices, and our legal support. And we don't have enough lawyers, we don't have enough counselors, and that it breaks my heart because somebody's actually said, okay, I'm ready, I want to do something, and we can't always help them today, and they wait. Mm.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Beth Hassett, CEO of WEAVE, which is the leading provider of support and resources for domestic and sexual violence in Sacramento County. You know, there has been a lot of progress and awareness as we were talking about. Well, what are still some of those big misconceptions that need to be dispelled?
I mentioned earlier, people say, why don't people just leave? Well, there are a lot of reasons people don't leave. So I think that's one big one. The other is just this notion that there has to be physical violence and specific physical violence. I think people picture being punched, and we see much more of being pushed, being shown a weapon can be physical violence, this idea that I might use this against you, but also financial abuse. Most of the people that come to us have some sort of financial abuse. They've either been coerced into getting into debt. They've signed documents and didn't know that they bought a car for their partner. They've been forced to work. They've been not allowed to work. So I think looking at that side of it is a big aha moment for a lot of people. And that further gets people into that hole of, well, I can't ever leave because I'm in debt now and I have a bad credit score. No one will rent to me. I will never get a job. Mm. So all of those things conspire to keep people in very dangerous and abusive relationships.
Yeah, it's manipulation and control.
It's all about power and control. And I think that's the other misconception is people picture, like this Lifetime movie version of, you know, this horrible controlling person. Often it ebbs and flows, and sometimes people are just very contentious couples. But if you really look at it, if there's a pattern of controlling behavior, that's what we're talking about, and that's what we're looking at. And that starts early. That's why we're in high schools and middle schools and elementary schools talking to 12-year-olds about what a healthy relationship looks like, because we need to get to those kids now so they don't become the victims later.
It's being aware of those red flags. I mean, what conversations should parents or guardians be having with their children to be mindful and aware of those red flags?
You know, talking about boundaries when it comes to sexual violence and the fact that you get to consent to things, talking about what a 12-year-old relationship looks like that can feel fun to a 12-year-old, like, oh, he follows me around all the time and texts me 20 times a day. Well, that's not the relationship you want when you're 25 years old. So really looking at what love looks like, what a healthy relationship looks like, and talking about it early on.
Yeah. What are still, there's a lot of challenges that remain. What are the biggest ones that remain? Especially, I mean, we're at the end. We just finished a legislative session. There were some bills that were signed into law. Do any have an impact for WEAVE and for these services?
You know, we are always looking at laws. We actually had our own that we got passed during the pandemic, which was to make online chat a service that agencies like WEAVE could offer that would count as a phone call, which sounds silly, but we launched it during COVID, and we get hundreds of people wanting to chat rather than make a voice call, which was critical during the pandemic. We're always looking at making sure that guns aren't in the hands of people who've been prohibited to have them. And just little things, like right now, I'm on the warpath to make it that you can't bail somebody out until they've had their arraignment after they've been arrested for domestic violence, that they at least have to have a hearing. Because what happens is people get arrested and then they start calling their victim over and over and over, and they end up bailing them out. Just a little thing like that could keep people safer, just to have one night to sleep on it and to not have to be pestered. Those little changes in the laws can make a big impact on victims.
Recently, you bring up gun violence, and during the pandemic, there has been an increase in the number of firearm purchases across the country. You know, we had Genoa Barro on from the Sacramento Observer, and they did work looking at the intersection, the link between gun violence and domestic violence. I believe WEAVE was a part of that. I mean, what do you want people to better understand about this intersection?
First of all, people aren't taking the guns away. Law enforcement's supposed to take those guns if somebody has a restraining order against them, and they aren't routinely taken away. It's very dangerous to take guns, so we depend on the AG's office to do that. The number one thing we could do is get the guns out of the hands of the people who've been told you're not allowed to have a gun. And oftentimes, victims don't realize there are guns in the house. So, yes, get rid of the guns and support any effort to take them out of the hands and prohibit people who are already prohibited. You know, we're not saying don't own a gun, but if you've been told you're not allowed to have a gun, we need to make sure as a society that people don't have them.
When thinking about what a survivor or a victim is, I mean, I think it's important on your homepage you have statistics, and I think often or historically people think of women, but men are also included, as well as people within the LGBTQ+ community. What do you want people to better understand about the people that you serve?
You know, we serve all sorts of people, and when we started really putting out there that we serve men and LGBT and non-binary people, they started coming. They saw themselves in our services, which I think is really important. And when we were talking about power and control, that's even more important when you're looking at a same-sex relationship, because it's not the standard male versus female. And when law enforcement's called, they really have to make a judgment call about who the aggressive party is. And a lot of people don't call because they're afraid they're going to be seen as the aggressor, especially if the male is a victim and the female is the perpetrator. So it's very nuanced, and it's the most frequent call for law enforcement. So we are always trying to train officers on, you know, you really need to look at who's in that power position and who has control in this situation.
That also involves collaboration, right, and building relationships.
We are embedded in 4 of the law enforcement agencies in this community, and those are important partnerships because we are constantly training them. We're talking to them about, how to be more empathetic if it's a sexual assault victim, how do you support a domestic violence victim, and we're there to do the follow-up immediately after the crime has been committed, and that's an important part of safety for people in our community.
You know, before, in the last few minutes that we have, I want to talk about tomorrow, because we will be premiering a short documentary as well as an original song. So let's talk about it. The short documentary is called Kim, and it's an 8-minute documentary. Tell us about who Kim is, Kimberly Dawn Landell.
She is a ballerina from Philadelphia, and it's a beautiful short film about her using her art to overcome domestic violence and continuing to use it to spark conversation and to get people talking about domestic violence and looking at it differently. And she'll be here, and she's going to do a little dance for us. So we're excited about that.
Yeah, I would imagine that resonates with so many people about finding that healthy outlet.
I love when people use the arts to either overcome and heal from sexual assault or domestic violence, or to help tell the story in a unique and interesting way. I just think it can really inspire people to think differently about these acts of violence.
And we also have Sacramento-based musician Clement Charles. He's going to release an original song, correct?
Yeah, you know, it's hilarious. I called him to see if he'd play at the event, and he goes, you know, I just wrote a song about domestic violence. I'm like, what? So it felt very, very much like it was meant to be. So yeah, I'm excited to hear this. I've seen a rough take of the song, but I've not heard it in person.
What prompted you or inspired you to reach out to Clement in the first place?
You know, I've known him for years, and I just think he just is such a warm and kind musician. And I thought, you know, he's the vibe that I want at this. And I just love him. He played at my daughter's wedding, actually, a year ago. And I thought he would be a gentle musician to have at this event.
Yeah, and the song, make no mistake, the proceeds will benefit we as well.
That is correct.
Yeah, 'cause money is good for your nonprofit.
Yes, it is.
Beth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Beth Hassett is the CEO of Weave, which provides domestic and sexual violence resources, support, and of course, prevention across Sacramento County. Still ahead, NPR's It's Been a Minute has a new host. My conversation with Brittany Luce ahead of her weekend debut about dissecting how pop culture shapes current events. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. NPR's It's Been a Minute explores how pop culture shapes current events. But for the past several months, the search has been on for a new host to take the place of Sam Sanders. That moment is here now. Brittany Luce is the new host of NPR's It's Been a Minute, a podcast as well as a radio show. Brittany is an award-winning journalist, a cultural critic with a love for podcasting. Most recently, she has been co-hosting the podcast for Colored Nerds. Brittany's work has been seen in The New York Times, The New Yorker, Vulture, Harper's Bazaar, as well as having a touch on NPR's Planet Money podcast. I spoke with Brittany ahead of her weekend debut. All right. Well, Brittany, it's so nice to see you via Zoom and welcome you to the NPR family.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You know, you have several years of podcasting experience. I'm just curious, what drew you to this medium?
Well, honestly, I started podcasts for fun as something to do with my friend back in 2014. I think what has been so great about podcasting and also what has allowed me to be able to like sort of break into the career that I've been able to have for the past 8 years is that the tools are pretty accessible. You can buy a microphone. You know what I mean? You can find free editing software. You can post a podcast and have it hosted somewhere for a relatively low amount of money. And so like, it was fun to be able to start a creative project with a friend without having to like overthink it or spend a lot in order to just try it out and get involved. So that honestly, like, low barrier to entry with regard to like the tools and knowledge to be able to start to use those tools, like, you know, from even just a hobbyist perspective, that was honestly what drew me in. But what's made me, what's sustained, I guess, my career over the past 8 years is just, I love the fact that through audio, I get to continue learning and I get to talk to so many different people and hear so many different experiences.
Yeah. I mean, it really can be an equalizer when you talk about it being entry level, especially from a cost standpoint. Yeah, this is far from obviously your first podcast venture. You and your colleague, Eric Eddings, have had a great deal of success with The Nod and For Colored Nerds. I mean, tell us about that origin story, because the both of you really saw a gap in conversations that you both believe needed to be filled.
Absolutely. We started making For Colored Nerds because we initially met at Howard University in Washington, D.C. and HBCU, where we became really close friends. And we always, not just between the two of us, but with our wider group of friends from Howard, who we're still very close to this day, we spent so much of our time at school and after we finished college just hanging out with each other. But having these in-depth conversations about the intersections of race, news, and pop culture all the time. We were having them on GChat every single day. Whenever Eric and I would meet up every few months, he hates talking on the phone, we would end up sitting down and having conversations like this for 5, 6, 7 hours. And, you know, we just decided, like, why not let other people into those conversations? Because these are the conversations that we're having, but not hearing out in the media. Now, this is back in 2014. No disrespect to people who are doing great work in journalism and blogging and other things like that. But with regard to audio, there were some really great, like, Black podcasters out there. But the sort of like nerdy, pop culture-y, newsy, pop culture-y conversations that we were having were not really being had as often back in September of 2014 when we got started.
Yeah, I mean, being talked about amongst friends and colleagues and, you know, and family for so many people, but not really being done in the way that the both of you really embarked upon it. Because, I mean, current events really do shape pop culture. I mean, I just think about recently, you can't talk about Serena Williams' impact and legacy on tennis without also having those necessary and hard conversations about race, discrimination, society's boxes on gender, the desire to have a family. I mean, it's endless. The list goes on and on. What draws you to these conversations and exploring these intersections?
That's a great question. I appreciate you asking that. What draws me to them is that, kind of going back to what we were just saying, like, these are things that come up in our conversations that we're having with our friends and family. But aspects of those conversations, even just the Serena example that you just used, I think about having a family all the time. I mean, yeah, even I think about Serena as someone who, I think in her HBO like documentary series from a few years ago, she shared that she had some complications in that first sort of like, I forget what, like the period immediately after she gave birth, like in the first 40 days. I learned from doing a little bit of reporting on this a few years ago that that is like a prime time for many Black women when they face these life-threatening post-childbirth complications. And she was one of those people who had those, you know, who experienced that type of like medical emergency. That comes to mind, even, you know, like I said, like you were just saying, even outside of the whole like double standards for men and women in their careers, like these are topics that actually touch us. And I think what pop culture allows us to do in a way is to have these avatars, these examples out there. And you know, I guess if Serena Williams or Beyonce, another Black woman who experienced some very serious childbirth complications, those are two of the richest Black women in the world, right? They probably have the best doctors, the best medical care. What that lets me know as an individual is this, you know, is this epidemic of Black women experiencing greater likelihood to go through these sorts of like medical emergencies with regard to childbirth. It connects it to like those very real statistics. And it makes me think about if that's their experience,
right,
what's going to happen to me? I mean, that's literally just one example of one person. Pop culture allows us to see ourselves. And I think a lot of us, for better or worse, project our desires, our fears, our beliefs onto these huge figures. And they shade how we think about news and current events and politics. And so I think that it's imperative that those things be studied, because I don't know, they're just so braided into our experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I love exploring that because it really offers you an opportunity to just pause and marinate and let things soak in, because, you know, what comes at us from, you know, apps or social media or what have you can just be relentless, that it's actually nice to pause and kind of just realize, like, all of this doesn't exist in vacuums, right? Like, they all right. are interconnected. It's not like every, like, these issues are all in their own room with the door closed, you know, they all impact
right,
each other.
Right.
So ultimately,
no, you're absolutely right.
Ultimately, oh, this basically led to NPR and you becoming the new host of It's Been a Minute. So
yes.
What is the origin story for that? How did that come about?
Well, I mean, honestly, it was like kismet. I remember when Sam first left the show, I wasn't thinking about like that as something like this job as something that I should be taking on. I was up to my neck in freelance work. And I also was preparing to get married. I decided to
You're
get married
newlywed,
in March.
Newlywed, that's right.
And I, yes, and I got married in May. So during the period of time when Sam was stepping down, I was literally just like, how am I going to find a shuttle bus that's going to carry all of my relatives around New York City and get them from City Hall to the restaurant? Like, I was so knee deep into that. But around that same time, I had started having conversations with Eric, actually, and also just with myself, about like what we wanted for the future, what I wanted for the future. And I, you know, I've spent years doing media, like working in media startups. I've done writing, editing, lots of hosting. I've done independent podcasting, but I realized I still hadn't done public radio. And also I hadn't been on terrestrial radio. There's something really special about It's Been a Minute, wherein it's this hugely successful podcast, but it's also a really beloved public radio show. And I wanted the challenge of taking over an existing show, making it my own, engaging with and hopefully winning over the audience, but also being able to reach so many different people across the country. Mm. So like after I came back from my honeymoon, someone had reached out to see if I was interested. And I mean, at that point, I had written down on like a post-it note, like literally sitting right next to me on my desk, what I was looking for in a next opportunity. And when It's Been a Minute, they reached out to see if I'd be interested in applying. It hit every single point that I was looking for. Honestly, I didn't even think they'd be thinking about me. I was like, I thought you guys would have filled this already with somebody else. But it just ended up being really right time, right show, perfect match.
Yes, very serendipitous and also well-deserved because of all the hard work that you did leading up to this moment. We only
Thank
have
you.
About a minute or so left. Any interviews that you can preview for us that you're really excited about?
Can't preview too much. I just started last Monday. We start publishing Friday. So I'm in the middle of, you know, I'm in the kitchen right now with the rest of the team who's been so incredible. I'm so grateful to learn from them. But we've got some really, really exciting and important conversations coming up about politics, about film, about history. And I was just saying that I had a really great conversation with a writer who applies philosophy and media theory concepts to the Kardashians and their antics.
I took a college course on like The Simpsons and philosophy. So, I mean, this is taking it to another level with the Kardashians.
That's really cool. But I totally see how that works out. I totally see how The Simpsons and philosophy works out. But I think that we got a little bit of something for everybody. So I'm excited to get started, you know, with these first few weeks and just see how the audience takes it.
Well, Brittany, it was wonderful getting to know you. And we're going to be hearing a lot more of you now. And I'm just excited for what's to come.
Thank you so, so much. I really appreciate you having me on today, Vicky.
And that was my conversation with Brittany Luce, the new host of NPR's It's Been a Minute podcast. And you can hear Brittany's first episodes this weekend on Cap Radio, as well as download the podcast. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineers are Antonio Munez and Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday. Have a fantastic weekend.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.